right, all right, all right. I'll tell you what, that is an amazing song. And every time I hear that song, I got nothing more I want to do than to get up and jump around. And that's why I got two extra people here in the studio to pull me back into my seat. Because when I hear Let There Be Drums, I am moving. I am up. I'm ready to run out the house. All right. And this is Let There Be Drums, Let There Be a Show. And today's show is extremely important. It's one of the ones that I'm really proud to bring you. And I think it's an extremely important show. And it's in every facet. During the second half of the show, we'll be talking with Googie Wathiongo. Now, Googie is one of my favorite writers, and he is a Kenyan-born author and major world writer, novelist, and cultural theoretician. And he's joining us to talk about the latest volume in his memoir, which is called In the House of the Interpreter. All right, and it's an extremely, extremely, very moving, very gripping book, but we'll be talking with Googie about that in the latter half of the show. But opening the show up, I'm extremely glad to be welcoming back to the show Deborah Sweet. And Deborah is the National Coordinator of World Can't Wait, and Deborah's joining us to talk about a new campaign that the World Can't Wait has going on, and it's an extremely urgent campaign. It's a campaign to run an ad in the New York Times in support of the Guantanamo hunger strikers and calling for the closure of Guantanamo. And the name of the ad is Stop the Torture, Close Guantanamo, End the War Crimes and Violations of Fundamental Rights. All right, Deborah Sweet, welcome to the show. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm well. Thanks, Michael.
Good. Well, let's jump into this because we have a limited amount of time and it's so damn important. World Can't Wait is currently working on an ad focused up around Guantanamo and the hunger strike. What's it about? Tell us about it.
We are providing a vehicle, a really crucial moment coming up on the 100th day of the Guantanamo prisoners' hunger strike, which is Friday the 17th. We looked at what's needed. People are protesting, doing petitions, fasting, not enough, of course, but some very visible protest has occurred, and people are very upset and very supportive of the hunger strike. What's been missing is the people of conscience, the notable names, the voices of conscience, artists, intellectuals, having a way to come together and say, close Guantanamo now. And as we've done seven times before, World Can't Wait decided very recently last week that this is what's needed. It's our contribution to creating a political situation where Obama could be forced to back off and start releasing some of the cleared prisoners and close Guantanamo very quickly. And that's the demand in the ad, close Guantanamo now, stop the torture, end the war crimes and violations of fundamental rights.
There's already a number of people who have signed on to it, and you've also, I noticed on your website, that you have already raised half of the money needed to do this, I guess, from getting this out to people and people being concerned and stepping up around this?
It's all come in donations of from $2 to $1,000. 300 people have given that money, and 800 people have signed it, including Dan Ellsberg, Eve Ensler, Dave Eggers, Glenn Greenwald, Paul Haggis, Bianca Jagger, Tom Morello, Mark Ruffalo, Carl Dick, Cindy Sheehan, Cornell West, people from across the spectrum. And, of course, we want younger artists. We want the people who have 6 million Twitter followers to be signing on to this ad. And we're actually kind of waging a political battle on Twitter right now where we are finding so many people who don't really know what Guantanamo is. So we're developing ways to talk about it in 140 letters. And our attitude right now is bring it on. We want this ad to really represent what millions of people could learn. We want it to be a message, at any rate, that gets to millions of people. And we want hundreds and thousands of people involved in really investing in it, both financially, putting donations in, but arguing for it in the world. And by the time it appears, which I hope will be sometime next week, as a full-page ad in the New York Times, it will really represent the hearts and the thinking of thousands and thousands of people.
One of the things that World Can't Wait brings up, and I thought this is extremely important in relation to all this, you make the comment that it's time and past time, which basically points out that there is an urgency in all of this happening. What is the situation at Guantanamo now? What is the urgency around this?
Well, these prisoners, some of them started hunger strike in early February. And some of them have been on hunger strike before. this weakens the body, and it's very, very hard on the mind and the spirit. I'm just reading a letter from Shocker Armor that Andy Worthington posted, where he talks about he has reckoning with the fact that during this hunger strike, he may die in prison. He's really looking at what this means, and he says, I sometimes worry I'm going to die in here. I hope I don't, but if the worst comes to the worst, I want my kids to know that I stood up for a principle. And the hatred of the brutality and treatment of the guards is as worse as it's ever been in Guantanamo. People are being deprived of drinkable water all day while they're fasting. They're being denied medical treatment, blankets, toothbrushes, just the most basic things that people need to live. All is punishment to make them stop their hunger strike, which is why we need so much, especially in this country, to express support for this hunger strike and to really pick up the demand to release the prisoners and close the illegal prison in Guantanamo now. Obama could do this. Look, he thinks he has the executive power to target and murder people all over the world with nobody's approval but his own. He could close Guantanamo.
You know, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because recently in a press conference, he stated that he really wants to close Guantanamo, but he's being blocked by Congress. What do you guys say to that? What do you make of that?
Well, I don't know if he wants to close Guantanamo or not. He might want to just because it is an embarrassment. It clearly has been. Even Bush said at the end of his two terms that he wanted to close Guantanamo. On the other hand, Obama's clearly committed to indefinite detention. It's part of the Obama doctrine and policy. So we could take that at face value, but he has the executive power, if he chooses to use it, to close Guantanamo right now.
Well, you know, one of the things, well, first, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Deborah Sweet, the National Director of World Can't Wait, and we're talking about the ad from World Can't Wait. That's basically standing in support of the Guantanamo hunger strikers and demanding the closing of Guantanamo. And the World Can't Wait is actually trying to basically get people to sign the ad and to donate to it in order to print this as an ad in the New York Times. Now, Deborah, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, you know, when you talk about Obama and what's going on here, part of the thing that it seems to be happening is when he talks about he wants to do this, a lot of the actions that he's taken actually sort of undercut anybody's like logical being able to come to a logical conclusion that, well, yeah, those are the actions of somebody who would really like to stop the torture, stop the, close down Guantanamo, you know, administer justice to what's going on. I mean, just for one, the April 13th military assault on the hunger strikers. This was an eye opener for many, many people.
And if they're trying to keep them alive and keep them from dying, the only means they're using is force feeding, which is a form of torture in its own right. It's recognized as a form of torture around the world. People are not being given the respect they deserve, number one, and the conditions under which they're being held, all of their communal areas were broken up, and they've all been thrown back into solitary confinement again, including the 86 prisoners who have been cleared for release for years and years, 5 and 6 years. They've been supposed to be able to leave and go home. They've not been even charged with anything, much less convicted. And they're being held in the worst conditions imaginable, just like in Pelican Bay in solitary confinement. Really outrageous. I remember, Michael, on January 11th of this year, standing in front of the White House. I was on your show, and there were hundreds of people with me, but we felt very subdued because nothing was going to happen on Guantanamo. Every avenue has been closed, legal and political. And then just a month later, the prisoners started this hunger strike. And it's, I won't say it's turned everything around. Obviously, it's at coming to a crucial point. But what has changed is that Guantanamo's been discovered in the news again, and Obama's had to talk about it. And now you have hundreds of people, thousands of people signing petitions, but hundreds of people signing this message, which I think really brings together a lot of things. the indefinite detention, the targeted killing, the going after whistleblowers like Bradley Manning, as part of a whole dangerous package that the Obama administration represents at this point. And you have the hope and the call at the end of this ad for people to stand up and not accept this, to say, you know, as we say at the end of the ad, it's up to people to stand up for principle and morality when their institutions and public officials refuse to do so. The fates of those who are maimed or killed by our government's policies are inextricably intertwined with our own. We must listen and respond to their cry for justice. We must demand their release now before they lose their lives as well.
Yeah, you know, very heavy. And actually, I was going to ask you, I have a couple questions related to that. You know, there is a point that at one point, I think it was World Can't Wait made this statement, but I know that there's at least it's in the same direction as World Can't Wait's previous statements. You made a point about that the actions of Obama and his administration, the actions of military personnel, and the inaction of a passive and silent public, those are the things that need to be called into question and roundly condemned. And how do you think that's going in terms of this, you know, actions and inactions of a silent republic?
Well, it's way, way, way too silent, and people have accepted things they never should have accepted on the one hand. But I will say that this courageous action of the prisoners, and it really started there with their standing up and saying, we refuse to be locked away and die like this. We're going to resist and do it in an organized way, has really changed the dynamic. And people, I will say, on Twitter, Facebook, on the internet, and this is where we're really engaging with people, are number one, at least asking questions about what is going on at Guantanamo. I thought it was closed. Who's there? The idea that most of the men there have never been charged with anything and never will be is a real revelation to a lot of people. They have accepted, many, many people, I think, that what happened in Guantanamo is history, that it must have been okay because nobody stopped it, or that Obama promised to close it and therefore it must be closed. And this is just a really, really important moment to provoke and open all this. And I think it's even important from the standpoint of the 80,000 people in the United States in solitary confinement. As we know that there will be a hunger strike. It's been called for July 8th, I think, in the United States against solitary confinement. And all the work I feel that we're doing about to support the hunger strike in Guantanamo is opening the way for people to really understand this is a huge epidemic in the United States. And we in World Can't Wait have been really challenging people with the idea of stopping mass incarceration by our government, whether it's in Guantanamo or it's domestic.
Okay, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Deborah Sweet, the National Director of the World Can't Wait organization. Now, Deborah, one other thing. You raised one other question on this line. You raised the point in a lot of your materials that Guantanamo plus silence equals death camps. Let's talk about that.
Well, there's a threat of a genocide here, and there's the threat, I guess, that people would accept this, that so openly the government of this country torturing people and fighting for the right to do so under the term of, you know, so-called enhanced interrogation. When this is put before people, I think the challenge is there. Look at what your government is doing, and you are the only one that can stop it. You in your millions, us in our thousands who see this now, have a responsibility to really challenge people with where this goes. You let the government start indefinitely detaining people without rights. How does that end? How does it stop without a very enraged, activated public saying, we will not accept it, whether it's done in Guantanamo or in Bagram, Afghanistan, Pelican Bay, Marion, Indiana, wherever it's done, we will not accept it. And that's the point of really challenging people with you cannot be silent. You have to speak up now.
But there's more to this. I mean, I'm just kind of curious because I think there's an important point here about Guantanamo plus silence equals death camp?
Well, it, you know, it's very literally true, isn't it? That they are, they being the U.S. government, the Obama administration at this point, is bringing in a lot more material into Guantanamo. We hear they're putting in a cardiac care unit. They've put in a whole new telephone system. They're going at this for the long haul. They don't intend to release people. They are going to literally let people die in Guantanamo, never having been charged with a crime, even though they were slated for release. And the only thing standing behind those literal deaths, between those literal deaths and what the government intends to do, are the voices of the people. So I think that's part of the death camp point.
Mm-hmm. I think, I agree. And I think actually one of the reasons I wanted you to talk about that is because I think people have to realize this isn't hype. When you're talking about death camp, it is actually true. And it adds a whole other dimension, a sharper dimension in terms of the reality of the need for people to stand up and condemn all this and to act against it. And along those lines, I'd like to ask you, the final question is, what about these global days of action to shut down Guantanamo that are coming up now?
Yeah, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the 17th through the 19th, is an opportunity for people around the world to be out visibly. People have been riding subway cars in orange jumpsuits in San Francisco and London. We want to do that, too, in New York. Reading the newspaper about Guantanamo and giving out flyers. There's a new song that's been done about our brothers are on a hunger strike that we're going to be performing in a flash mob on Times Square Friday and at Union Square on Saturday. We're going out very, very strenuously to talk to people on the streets about this. And the demand of all of this international action is close Guantanamo now and immediately release the cleared prisoners. For those who are detained indefinitely, the ones who the U.S. government can't charge and won't try because they were tortured, and the government doesn't want that torture to come out, we also demand, and World Can't Wait, charge those people, try them, and allow them to get out. Mm-hmm. But this is going to be a really, really big battle. And again, the point of doing this ad in the New York Times is to give the voices of conscience, the filmmakers, actors, writers, clergy people, anybody who has some name recognition in this society to come together and say very, very publicly in front of millions of people, this has to end now. Close Guantanamo, stop the torture, and stop these devastating attacks on people's fundamental rights.
All right, Deborah, and before we leave each other, how about you tell people where they can find out more information about the ad and how they can participate in it?
WorldCan'tWait.net. On Twitter, we're WorldCan'tWait. On Facebook, we are WorldCan'tWait.
All right, and all of us should be. We in the world can't wait either, okay?
So, right.
There you go. All right, Deborah, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Bye.
All right, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Deborah Sweet, the National Director of World Can't Wait. And we've been talking about their ad that they want to place in the New York Times around Guantanamo. Stop the torture, close Guantanamo, end the war crimes and violations of fundamental rights. And this is an ad that will be in support or is in support of the Guantanamo hunger strikers and the prisoners there, saying that this is a war crime of just gigantic proportions and dimensions. All right. So check that out. Go to worldcan'twait.net and check out. Learn all you can about it and then break the silence. Okay. All right. We're going to take a quick musical break. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Googie Wat Thiong'o, the author, cultural theorist, great writer, great novelist, and we'll be talking about the newest volume in his memoirs, which is In the House of the Interpreter. So stay tuned. Thank you. All right, welcome back. You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and that was Mau Mau by Art Farmer. All right?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. And the man saying, oh, wow, is someone who knows Mau Mau first up, firsthand and close up. And that's Googie Wat Thiong'o. Googie is one of my favorite writers, actually probably my favorite writer in the world.
Oh, wow, thank you.
There you go. Sure, sure, sure. And Googie is also a professor of comparative literature at UC Irvine and constantly on the mumbled about, spoken about, and sometimes getting very close to Nobel Prize in Literature. And he's written books that have changed the world, that have moved the world, that have moved hundreds of thousands of people to think about things very differently. And we've had Googie on, oh, I guess we had you on first time a number of years back. And
yes, I think I've become a frequent visitor to your studios. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. And you're here now. Googie Wat Thiong'o is here now to talk about the second volume in his memoir. And this one is called In the House of the Interpreter, a memoir. Googie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to have you back, man. We've been talking about doing this for a while, but
I know. We had a program on my first memoir, Dreams in a Time of War. Yeah. So this is a second memoir.
Right.
Following my first one, Dreams in Time of War. And I still remember Dreams in a Time of War really is a memoir about my childhood, growing up literally in a time of war. Fast forward the Second World War, and then also within Kenya, where I come from, the Mau Mau War against the British colonial state. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, your second book, the second volume, does pick up on that, and it continues that kind of theme thematically in terms of an overview. What sets the stage for how your second volume of the memoir unfolds, don't you think?
Yeah, exactly. What happens is the first memoir, ends when I've just been accepted into the most prestigious African secondary school in Kenya, all the time. For as your listeners know, Kenya used to be a British colonial state, meaning it was a settler state. There was a white settlement there, and everything, of course, at the time was completely, racialized into whites at the top, Asians in the middle, and Africans, at the bottom. This was the background of my childhood. Now, when I go to Alliance High School, it's a very different. No, it's not really different, but I'm very interested in looking back, that I'm in this little bubble, very wonderful bubble, secondary school. I'm reading Shakespeare. I'm reading, Wordsworth. And outside the walls of Alliance High School, war is actually going on. People are dying in the streets, people being hunted down and so on, So my memoir, In the House of the Interpreter, tries really to show the intersection between school and what's going outside. Initially, I think they are two separate entities, but later reality sets in and I realize they are actually part of each other, that you can talk of education here, school here, and what's happening out of the school as another reality. In my own case, they actually, in the memoir, they actually do dramatically, come together.
Mm-hmm. And well, let me ask you a question, just so people know. The House of the Interpreter, what does that mean?
It's actually, the title is taken from Bunyan's, Pilgrim's Progress, where, Christian in his journey towards, the city of God, I suppose, comes across, passes through the house of the interpreter. And there's whole symbolism about dust and water and the spirit and all that, very important in his journey. Now, the headmaster of my school, Carrie Francis, used to think of Alliance High School, which was basically also a missionary school, as the house of the interpreter, where, you know, I suppose the dust we brought from our various, you know, cultures and so on would somehow be cleansed, you know, by, I suppose, education and Christian principles, you know.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Gugi Watthiyongo about the second volume in his memoir, and it's called In the House of the Interpreter. Now, Gugi, one of the things when you started to talk about, you know, I was really struck by this, you know, and I want to explore this a little bit where you talk about how initially you looked at and you can't continually refer to, even as it's breaking down, your view of the school as a sanctuary and yet the reality of colonial rule. In the beginning, you do look at them as very separate, but you're still confronted with that. Every time you're in the sanctuary, you think one thing and then you come out and reality slaps you in the head.
Because I think that's how the school and the school system was set up to do, you know, to think of school and schooling as a liminal space that has the separate from the norm, from the reality. But in fact, of course, we do see the liminal space, liminality is purely imaginary. The reality is, you know, that every space reflects also the larger social, you know, social space. So it's in a way, it's almost like an illusion. Initially, you go in thinking, well, now you're in school, it's a boarding school. And for a time, you do actually feel protected from what is going on outside. But the reality is much bigger than any educational, protective walls. Yeah.
Let's talk about that a little bit more, because when you, one of the first times where that really strikes you really hard is when you leave the school on your first break and you go home and you find your village has disappeared.
That was a most traumatic experience for me and those who have followed my writings from Weeping Child through As We Wizard of the Crow, you know, will recognize this theme of return. You know, if you remember in the memoir what happens, I came from a village, you know, a rural community of scattered homesteads. But somehow or other we had forged a sense of community, no matter how impoverished it may have been. So I go to Alliance High School. It's a boarding school. In those days, of course, remember in those days, there are no emails, even to get a letter from one place to another took years, more or less, literally. So there's no communication between me and home. So after 3 months, I return to my village, which is not literally very far. It's about 20 miles. But in those days, it's like another world. And I had these high expectations, you know. I think of my mother who sent me to school. I think of my brothers, you know, and there's a sense of triumphant return, expectation of triumph and conquest, if you like, and a certain kind of reception you are imagining. But when I get home, or what I thought was home, it was no more. The British had erased the entire village to the ground, you know, burnt down houses, raised down others. So the entire landscape for me was absolute and utter desolation. And I did not know this because there had not been any communication about this. So I stand there, completely stunned, not know where to turn, sit on my luggage, and nothing is making sense, okay? Later, of course, I do discover that the entire village community had been moved into what was called the village, but really it was a concentration village, you know, where people have put together the entire community, placed in one location around which would be a moat, you know, and there will be a complete system of surveillance, you know, from morning to evening. The idea being is a way of disconnecting the link between the community and the guerrilla, you know, fighters in the mountain. Now, one thing you might want to know, because I'm in a school at Alliance High School, remember? Alliance High School, a missionary school, or a product of an alliance of missions. And every morning, we are singing, "God Save the Queen," you know, "Long May She Reign Over Us," every single morning. But every single morning, I'm also aware that my brother is part of the guerrilla army in the mountains, you know, Mount Biological, the one I follow, is the mountains, you know, fighting against the British colonial presence so the Queen may not long reign, you know, over us, you know. So that devastation made a very big impact on my life. And it's only now that I'm able to connect that to many other, the devastation that really the British colonial state carried in those days in Kenya really was unprecedented, you know. It's incomparable to what I think the Germans did in the Second World War, literally. And it's only now that we are recognizing that what the British did, you know, the killings, the mass rape, the cutting people's ears and limbs and so on. I mean, this was going on, was an everyday affair. And it's only now that people are really beginning to write, you know, about it. For instance, there is a settlement. I think the judgment was put, I think, recently. Some Mau Mau fighters or remnants brought a case against the British government. And the court in London, wherever, has agreed that the British government is liable for the mass killings and rapes and cutting of limbs and so on that went on in Kenya, you know, with the whole world blind what the British actually are doing in Kenya, right?
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Gugi Wathiongo about the second volume in his memoir, and it's called In the House of the Interpreter. And in fact, they were blind to it, and then there were films and stories that actually came out and portrayed the Mau Mau as being, they're the ones that are terrible, they're the ones that are doing all this. And meanwhile, the Brits are the British Imperials are...
So what I'm finding very amazing today is that I used to write about all these things, even in the same graphic details, in my novels, you know. And they are, oh no, it could not be like that. But now, in the British High Court or whatever, you know, this is there, out there, you know, in the open. But for many Kenyans, that was actually the reality of their everyday for about 5 years, from 1952 to when actually, literally to 1962, for 8 years, 1960 or 62. We got our independence in 1963, you know. So in the House of the Interpreter, I'm talking about the struggle. It's almost a continuation of the notion contained in the Brechtian poem that precedes in the preface to Dream in a Time of War, where I say that even in time of war, we shall we sing? Yes. Even in time of war, we shall sing about the war. So in a time of difficulties, we can also dream about possibilities of getting out of the intolerable, you know, present. You know. So in other sense, in how the interpreter is really, in a way, a continuation of the notion of dreams in a time of war. Is even dramatization, if you like, of the importance of dreaming, not in a dreamy sense, literally imagining an alternative, imagining a different future, imagining something different. Otherwise, you succumb to And I remember this very clearly. Because if I had, at a personal level, if I had succumbed to actual reality of the time, in terms of the everyday, it was completely devastating. No homes, you know, surveillance every day, you know, relatives in the mountains either dying or themselves or fighting, mothers and sisters in and out of prisons and so on. I mean, it was all those were realities that were going on. But not for me, for thousands of other Kenyans. It was not individual to me, Gogi. It was actually the reality of many Kenyans at the time. Yeah.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Gogi Wathiongo about his latest edition of the second volume of his memoir, and it's in the House of the Interpreter. Gogi, one of the things I wanted to actually ask you, but right on that question, because Alliance High School was also a place where even where the headmaster made it very clear, the African youth that were brought there were brought to coalesce, to form, to shape, to become part of a regime or a, you know, a class of people that would be, you know, a leadership that would actually be amenable to yeah. you know, to the British colonialists. And how did it, you know, because then you're looking at that and you know that. You even say in your book at one point, we all knew that our future is made in England. But you also say, you know, you're also coming from outside those walls and you know what's going on, and you often refer to the hound, you know, the hounds are at the gate.
Yeah. The real the hounds, if you like, the hounds at the gate, you know, and the heaven in England, kind of, or made in England, anyway, that kind of, you know, a contradiction. So Alliance High School is very interesting, by the way, because it's a way you get the American connection, because it was actually modeled very much on initial beginnings, 1920s, was modeled on the Virginia Hampton Institute and Tuskegee Institute. This was the inspiration, the Booker T. Washington model of both self-reliance but also a malleable, civic-minded black people who had come out of slavery, you know, kind of attitude. So Tuskegee and Virginia Hampton Institute actually were seen as models for colonial education in West Africa, South Africa, and East Africa. In fact, the commission that funded the foundation of my school was actually based in New York, okay, that particular fund. And same fund is the one who funded similar commissions for Native American education and African-American education in this country. But it produced very interesting. But history is not, never, never one-sided. Right? You know, and I'm always in the House of Interpreters. I'm interested in the contradiction embodied for instance in my headmaster. You know, my headmaster, Carrie Francis, he was an officer of the British Empire, knighted by the Queen for his services to the Emperor. Yeah, right, on one hand. But at the same time, at a very personal level, he is a guy who resigns from a professorship in mathematics in Cambridge in 1920-something to go and become a headmaster initially of a small primary school called Maseno, somewhere in Kenya at the time, remote, nothing, no teachers, nothing. So he gives up something at a personal level to go and work there, you know, as a missionary teacher or whatever, you know, giving his all, you know. Right. Again, as I say, he believed the ideals of the empire. He believed the empire was a good thing. But at the same time, he's a guy who spent day and night documenting, literally, every wrong thing that was being done by the colonial, even during the time of war, you know, what the British were doing against, you know, Africa. He documented in order to when protest about this, you know, to the colonial governor, or sometimes you'd actually go to England, talk to the Royal Society about the atrocities which they were doing. And at one time he says, look, you'll never defeat. He said, Mau Mau is horrible, is everything, but it is a liberation movement. You know, so those kind of contradictions, you know, where body in the same person.
Let me ask you this, and I do want to, and remember, people, we're talking with Gugi Wathiongo about the second volume of his memoir, In the House of the Interpreter. Now, Gugi, I want to have you read a section from the memoir, but I want to set this up in a way that we can come back and talk about it after your reading too, because one of the things one of the points that you've made in talking about the book, in the book itself, you make a point where you say that, you know, actually, while the school existed to train this sort of supervisory class among Africans for the colonial system, at the same time, it also generated a certain feeling, a certain amount of nationalism, a certain amount of rebellion, a certain amount of people pushing back against that, yourself included.
These rebels also.
Yeah, right, exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say, rebels, right. Exactly. And that was very important, including in one thing where I know you went into the library, spent a lot of time in the library, and you really honed a sense of contradiction there, I think. It was really, you know, you could see what you were doing when you look at the books and you'd say, I like these books, but all of them portray Africans in a certain way. All of this is done in a certain way. Where is, you know, and you saw the sense of contradiction. And one of the things that struck me in your book where you really grasped this sense of contradiction and you really – very, very adept at presenting it in a way that just sort of makes you step back and go, whoa, that's an exposure there. That's something that people can really look at and say, now I can see some truth. So can we read the section? This is on when the Soviets sent up the Sputnik, the first satellite, and then they sent a dog up. And there's a whole uproar that happens in Kenya and in the school itself.
Yeah. First of all, let me contextualize it a little bit. You know, one of these which I'm very fascinates me on looking back in my life, but generally, is the connection between the phenomena. How things, we may think that certain things which are happening, say, in a place I come, in my locality, are disconnected from things which are happening in another locality in a different part of the world, you know. But actually, I find they are very much connected. And what's happening to you may actually be as a result of other things happening, you know, occurring, you know, elsewhere. So I'm very interested in the connection, the linkages between even two apparently different regions or different histories, then you find actually they're not all that different, that they are linked to each other. So this is, in my school, whenever there's something happened in the world, the headmaster or somebody would hold an assembly, you know, to talk about it. And so it's what's called civic education. So the question of the Soviet Union, or rather Soviet, the Sputnik 1. On October 4th, a month into the third term, the Soviets, or the Russians as we called them, launched Sputnik 1 into space, the first man-made Earth-orbiting satellite in history. For some reason, this did not make a splash at our school. But on November 4, everything changed. News reached Kenya, as it did all over the world, that the same Russians had now launched Sputnik 2, and it carried a dog named Laika. This event raised a hue and cry from white people from all corners of the colony. The Russians had sent a dog to die in space. At an emergency school assembly, Carrie France condemned this premeditated cruelty. Some students could not understand how the death of a dog in space could spur such anger and grief. For me, Laika rhymed with Malaika, and it sounded as if an angel had been sent to space. But then, angels dwelt in heaven beyond the clouds. So an angel sent to die in heaven? Then I learned that Laika was actually a stray dog from the streets of Moscow. The code word for stray dogs, Guishia Jagri, or simply Jagri, was also the word for the homeless and the irresponsible. Boys threw stones at stray dogs. Despite the fact that dogs had once bitten me, I never could understand their scream. I could never stand their screams. They eerily evoked the cries of humans in pain. In our village, stray dogs turned into hordes of marauders roaming the streets, often fighting among themselves for leftovers. The hungry dog became bolder, sometimes growling and snatching food from little children and old people. The colonial state must have given the order to reduce their population because there came a time when, instead of boys chasing dogs for fun, it was armed home guards hunting and gunning them down. Hunting dogs became an official colonial sport. Three or four policemen would chase the dogs across hills and valleys, competing with each other to see who could bark the most. By zigzagging and zagging with speed, the dogs often frustrated their markmanship. During the entire anti-stray dog campaign, I never heard of voices raised in protest. And now, this outburst for Laika. Looking back on all the dogs killed in our village, I could not help noting the irony that a stray dog from the streets of Moscow had done what no human had ever done before. That though forced, a Jagri had been the chosen vehicle for dramatizing the dawn of a new age. Once again, for me, the street had demonstrated its power.
Very good, very good. And let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Gugi Watthiyongo about the second volume in his memoir, and it's called In the House of the Interpreter. You know, we have about a minute and a half, 2 minutes left. It goes so fast, man.
Right.
It goes so fast.
Right.
But, you know, one thing I wanted to get into really quick, because there's so much you deal with in this. You deal with your struggle with religion. You deal with all these things. But in the end, you come out with – there's a character in the book. And if you can do this in about a minute, it would be great.
Right.
But there's a character in the end of your book, Mr. Body Parts, which I just thought what he said really brought things – concentrated things in such a way that it was just so moving and so heartfelt in terms of exactly that point where you're talking about you're living in these two worlds. And then at a certain point – you're in that other world, and you have to decide what to do.
Yeah, they come together, you know, towards the end of the in a very dramatic ways, in which your readers will be able to see. And what happens to me in the memoir, towards the end, I'm still a school kid, 4 years at secondary school. I'm about to go to college, you know, and then I'm arrested for nothing, absolutely nothing, you know. And I'm put in custody for 5 days. It's the most horrible, you know, experience for me. And how I got out of it is also the subject of In the House of the Interpreter.
What can we look forward to? Is there a third volume coming out?
Yes, I want to do one more volume, which is to do my memoir of college days. Because what happened is I entered Makerere University College of Uganda as a colonial subject. 4 years later, or 5 years later, I graduated from the college and returned home to Kenya as a free citizen. So my graduating from college and my becoming a citizen as opposed to a colonial subject happened about the same time. And I won't tell that story. I think it's dramatic. I think it's interesting.
All right. Yeah. And it also opened the gate to a man who also emerged more completely as a rebel in every sense of the word. And I think, you know, even I was thinking about your decolonizing.
Or a dream of a new world. How about
dream
that?
Of a new
dream
world.
Of, the dream of our possibilities.
There you go.
Right,
there you
right,
go.
Right.
All right. Gugi Watthiyongo, thank you very much for joining us today. And your book is In the House of the Interpreter, a memoir. Gugi, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sure. Yeah. All right. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. And we've just been talking with Gugi Watthiyongo, the author of In the House of the Interpreter, a memoir. All right. Well, that wraps up another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Gugi Watthiyongo and Deborah Sweet from the World Can't Wait organization. And I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. And here's something a little new. If you want to throw your comments at me, have any comments, have any questions, or just want to say, hey, how you doing? Let me know what's going on. Or you want to check out what I'm thinking about that's important in the world today, you can go to michaelslate.wordpress.com, and you'll be able to get an answer. You'll be able to get a back and forth. You'll be able to have a good time, okay? And if you want to follow me and you want to do it in a discreet and not creepy way, in a just kind of normal way, a nice way, a friendly way, you can do that on Twitter and Facebook. And I do want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And in closing out today's show, before we go into that last going out song, I've been thinking a lot about this. Bob Avakian just issued a statement called Nat Turner or Thomas Jefferson. And just the other day, I was reading a newspaper where there was this scurrilous attack on China when it was a socialist country, just chock full of lies and backpedaling and backstabbing and everything. It was just a really dirty, 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 made your skin crawl because there was absolutely nothing true about it. So I wanted to read this statement from Avakian and encourage you to let me know what you think about it, what your thoughts are on all this. Wherever you are, you can write to me again, michaelslate@redfuture.com, or you can go to michaelslate.wordpress.com and drop us a line and your thoughts on this, all right? So it's Nat Turner or Thomas Jefferson. Slave rebellion or slave master? Do you support the oppressed rising up against the oppressive system and seeking a radically different way, even with certain errors and excesses? Or do you support the oppressors and the leaders and guardians of an outmoded oppressive order who may talk about inalienable rights but bring down wanton brutality and very real terror on masses of people to enforce and perpetuate their system of oppression? This speaks to a basic question of stand and orientation and represents a fundamental dividing line. And along with setting the record straight on the actual experience and role of communist revolution and refuting the factual and methodological distortions involved in the attacks on communism, this basic question, as represented by Nat Turner or Thomas Jefferson, also needs to be sharply posed in relation to the history of communism and the present-day struggle for communist revolution in opposition to the capitalist imperialist system, which still dominates the world with such terrible consequences for humanity and for the environment. Do you stand with this oppressive system or with the struggle to overthrow and uproot it and bring into being a radically different, emancipating system and way of life? Do we need to learn from not only the overwhelmingly positive experience of the communist movement so far, but also its shortcomings, including sometimes serious errors and even excesses? Yes, this is an important part of the new synthesis of communism. And it is crucial in order to be able to do even better in the new stage of communist revolution. But this can only be done in the fullest way by taking up and applying the scientific communist method and approach that leads, first of all, to standing firmly and consistently on the right side of this fundamental dividing line between oppressors and oppressed. And beyond that, makes it possible to correctly assess and learn from the rich experience of the struggle against oppression throughout history and in all parts of the world, including the shortcomings involved in this experience, in order to carry forward the fight to the final goal of communism and the emancipation of the oppressed, and ultimately humanity as a whole, from all forms and relations of oppression and exploitation, domination and degradation everywhere in the world. Again, that's from Bob Avakian. It's a statement called Nat Turner or Thomas Jefferson. And you can find that at revcom.us, that and the other works by Avakian, and Revolution Newspaper. So go there. You can actually hook into the revolution. All right, revcom.us. We're going to go out now with a song that has become one of my favorite songs recently, and it's a song from Lupe Fiasco, and that song is called Around My Way, Freedom Ain't Free. Talk to you next week.
Yeah. Great American rap resurrect. Rest in peace, young F. Born live on the set. Born live on the set. Yeah.
First off, say peace to Pine Ridge. Shame and all the damage that the white man wine did. Ghost dance, trail of tears, 5 million beers a year, and all that other crime did. More pieces to the teachers of blind kids, to red bells and small cells, keeping their mind big. Say
everything's hostile. Suicide bombers and prosperity gospels. Emaciated models with cocaine and blood pouring out their nostrils. They got to, just to stay awake on the catwalk of life where everybody watch you. Straight hair, high heels, and a handbag. Crucifixes, racism, and a land grab. Katrina, FEMA, trailers, human body sandbags. A peace sign and a pants sag. A money toss calls a nine-stripper mad dash. A friend request following a hashtag. Now everybody want it like the last laugh. A Michael Jackson jacket or a death mask. Purple Jordans or the mixed girl in your math class. Stable is when the bath had Baghdad. But corporate jets really had to have that gas band. War and they hope they all fall from the rat attack. Cause that's just more dinosaur for the Cadillacs.
Live from the other side, what you see. A bunch of nonsense on my TV. Heaven on earth is what I need. When I feel I'm in hell every time I breathe. One line from the outside, what you hear? A bunch of nonsense all in my ear. Rich man, poor man, we all gotta pay. It's freedom ain't free, especially round my
and
way.
Wait. Marvel at the state of all the man. They turn around and treat Ghana like a garbage can. America's a big motherfucking garbage man. If you ain't know, you part and parcel of the problem. You say no, you ain't, and I say yes, you is. Soon as you find out what planned obsolescence is. You say no, they didn't, and I say yes, they did. The definition of unnecessary nears. Manifested. Say that we should protest just to get arrested. That goes against all my hustling ethics. A bunch of jail niggas say it's highly ineffective. Depart from Martin, connect on Malcolm X tip. Insert Baldwin, the similar to separate. To me, the truth is more fulfilling than a method of finding really fast internet to have some sex with. It's all one song short of a set list. Couple croissants shy of a continental breakfast. Of blowing out your birthday candles just to make a death wish. So absurd, word to Chief Bone Necklace. Down at the Lakota Sioux Casino, a whole culture boiled down to giving you Pekino. I go as left as a heart in the chest, cause the Horn of Africa is now starving to death.
Live from the other side, what you see? A bunch of nonsense on my TV. Heaven on earth is what I need. When I feel I'm in hell every time I breathe. Born live from the other side, what you hear? A bunch of nonsense all in my ear. Rich man, poor man, we all gotta pay. It's freedom ain't free, especially round my way.
And all white Los Angeles, the dream of Mr. Chandler. Hope and pray they take Columbus Day up off the calendar. South Central, an example of God's gift. So shout to all the mothers raising babies in Spa 6. The projects of Oakland City, Detroit, ghost towns. Monopolies on poverty where D-Boy Coke bound. It's parts of Manila like the video for Thriller. But the U.S. Embassy is reminiscent of a villa. If poverty is chocolate and privilege vanilla, then what's the flavor of the Sunday preacher's pedophilia? Cash rules everything around these niggas. There's classrooms everywhere around me with her. Hither you can be Mr. Burns and Mr. Smithers. The tyrant or the slave, but nowhere in the middle of the extremes of America's dream. Freud fighting Neo, Freddy Cougar refereeing, man.
Live from the